Welcome back to our Web API Design Jumpstart. Alongside Jeremy Alichnis, I am Christopher Harrison. And, you know, I hit it already off my Q&A, so I can't remember who it was. I want to say his name was Martin, and if I've just completely flubbed that, forgive me, but I'm pretty sure that was the name. But Martin asked a fantastic question, which is, you know, what's the great advantage of making this move from WCF and SOAP calls into doing REST, Web API, OData? I mean, why is that so cool? Why not just keep doing WCF?
Sure. So there's several reasons, and I ran into this firsthand several years ago. I was working at a company, and we were working on mobile device management. And we started putting agents on devices, and of course, we were a WCF shop at the time, and found out that a lot of the mobile devices didn't have the libraries, and it was a lot of overhead to take a SOAP message, break it apart, dissect it, and make that operate. So I would say there are really two key advantages that we found with using REST, and there's some more philosophical ones about the way it uses HTTP, but we can get into that. I mean, one is, this is, so I'll make it three. One is actually that it does use the browser's HTTP mechanism. So it's a well-known protocol. Typically, firewalls are already open to that. There's security around it through secured sockets layers. So it just makes for a good transport, if you will, a means for standing up APIs. But the two real drivers that we saw were, number one, is that it takes less overhead to process a REST request, which is very important for mobile.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the trends today are people want to access their data anywhere,
yep,
anytime,
absolutely,
from any device.
Yep.
And so having a consistent way to get that out to the devices is key.
Yep.
So that's number one. Number two, which sort of ties into number one for the advantage too, is that REST facilitates this content negotiation and exposing JSON data instead of XML. And it turns out that JSON was designed with JavaScript in mind. And I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek because JSON really is JavaScript, but it makes it very easy for JavaScript, whether it's a browser, client code, et cetera, to take that payload and process it. It's built into the engine,
right,
as opposed to XML, which has to be parsed and traversed, et cetera. So it reduces that overhead
and
for
just
that transport.
The verbosity there of XML, that if you compare an XML document to a JSON document, the size difference is astronomical.
Sure.
And again, spinning that back into mobile devices, you know, remember that especially when you're talking about a phone and to a lesser extent a tablet, that the vast majority of the time, the way that people are connecting is not going to be through Wi-Fi, it's going to be through cellular data. So anything at all that you can do to limit the amount of information that you're going to be sending down is not only going to help keep your users' bills down, but it's also going to make things that much faster.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. So in that prior module, like we sort of said, we took a high-level overview of REST and Web API and a little bit of Visual Studio. And then, you know, we took a look at this Postman thing. And, you know, a lot of people asked, well, what about Fiddler? You know, why don't we start digging into this? So,
sure.
So talk to me more about how we can start designing our Web API here, how we can start building it.
Sure. Absolutely. So we're going to jump into several things. First is defining the resource. I want to dive into REST a little bit more and talk about a strategy for that. So we're going to put the demos off just a little bit. Bear with me. It's good information, and it'll be very helpful. We'll talk about verbs in the Web API. So what are the accepted ways of interacting with services?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be this one. Then we're going to talk about content negotiation. We jumped into that a little bit in the last module, but how do you, A, request, I want data in this format, and B,
right,
serve it from Web API. And then just what you spoke to, tools for testing, and I'll show you a few different tools and how we can use those. And then I'm going to jump into part of that, well, what is so cool about REST compared to WCF? I'm going to give a demo of consuming a REST endpoint in jQuery, which I'm not sure I would be able to write if it was a SOAP-based service.
Perfect.
So that's exactly what we'll cover. And let me jump out of my Zoom it. So the first thing is planning the API. And that is any type of problem that we're looking to tackle and solve, we want to start out with, you know, what is the problem? How do we tackle the solution? So as much as we as developers love to go in, file a new project, take the web API and get to work, there is some planning and design behind how we're going to handle that interface. And so there's some standards that exist around REST that includes the idea of collections versus singletons. So it's pretty common to expose an endpoint with a plural that says, I have a collection of products, like what we saw on the O data, and then have a specific, you know, either parentheses zero or slash zero to reference a specific product within that collection. We also have a concept called navigation. And in navigation, what we're doing is we're looking at widgets that contain other things within the widget. So you always have objects that compose other objects. Mm-hmm. So how do you navigate through those? And so there's some well-defined ways within REST that you can expose that. And I show an example here in this screen, and we've got this whole concept here of this is a specific widget that has a collection of things. Mm-hmm. And then over here, I'm actually going directly to that thing. That's number one within things. And so we would assume we could pop back up and go to thing slash one as well. So we've got this concept of nouns. Resources, and this is where I talked about where remote procedure calling mm-hmm. is not the way we design REST APIs. It's not a do this verb. It's actually a resource, which is a noun, and then we have verbs that act on that noun. So we always want the URI to represent a resource.
Okay.
Okay. And then it's really just the target of a hypertext reference. So if you can type it into your browser, that's the idea of a resource. I should be able to get to it from that browser window.
Okay, so it's the noun, that's where we define, hey, this is the object in question, and then the verb is going to identify what we want to do to it. So if I say get, I'm looking to download it. If I say post, I'm looking to make a modification. If I say put, I'm looking to create a new one, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Actually, put replaces, post adds a new, but...
I always get those backwards. Forgive me.
Sure.
Thank you.
It happens. I do, too, all the time.
Okay.
So the next thing we want to talk about is just this idea of exposing business logic. So when you're building these APIs, you have to ask yourself, did you build it in a way that the consumer has to figure out all of the logic around how things are processed? Or are you building it in a way that you can encapsulate that business logic, which is what you know and you're the expert of within your application? I'm going to show you an example of what that looks like. And then semantics behind the scenes in web API, typically what you call a resource is going to map one-to-one to a controller. That's usually the convention. If I have a widgets API endpoint that's mm-hmm. a collection, there's probably going to be a widgets controller that services that.
Perfect.
So I'm going to start with a few resource examples, and I'm a big fan of not assuming that I know the best way to approach things, so I like to see those proven methods out there, right? And this has been there, done that, right, with other companies.
There is... The name is going to come to me eventually, there's this fantastic author, and basically the way that he put exactly what you just said a bit more succinctly was, I find it easier if I just assume that I'm too stupid to figure out what the correct way is. So rather than me going off and trying to build from scratch and do it all on my own, is let me go see what's been done, let me go see what's been tried and tested, and then take advantage of what's already been built. That, you know, other people have already been down that path. Other people have already figured out good ways to attack certain problems. Let's take advantage of what they've done rather than assuming that we always know a better way to do things. So yeah,
absolutely.
I really like that. So yeah, so you're going to kind of walk through like, hey, this is how Twitter does it, and this is how other web API, or I should say REST implementations do their thing.
Sure, sure. So I've got three examples in this module. And the first two examples we're going to touch lightly, and then we'll dig deep into the third example. And what I'm showing here is resource examples for Twitter. And in Twitter, you've got this concept of users. That's a collection that Twitter exposes and statuses. And by the way, any of this that I'm showing, we can hop over. Twitter has a dev.twitter.com, and that is going to show exactly what the API looks like. So we've got a list of REST APIs, and if we scroll down here, we can see, you know, here's an example of getting statuses and mm-hmm. retweets, et cetera. But what's interesting is what you'll see with the way that this API is designed is statuses is a collection, mm-hmm. and then we navigate within statuses to a user timeline, to a home timeline, to a retweets timeline.
So they give you, hey, here's our tweets, and then you drill down into the specific types of tweets
exactly.
that you're looking for.
Okay. Right. So it's like a qualifying, kind of a common filter, if you will, and it works.
I mean,
because your common usage is probably going to be, hey, I want to get retweets. And so it doesn't make sense to have statuses with a really convoluted filter to try to do that. It makes sense to just hit that as a resource. So you have followers and trends, and a few other things.
By the way, we could always use new followers. So I'm at Geek Trainer over here. That's at Jeremy Lickness. You know, we could always use new followers. So there's
Absolutely.
A shameless plug looking for new followers on Twitter. You can find us right there.
All right. Great.
Anyway, back to the APIs there.
Right. So this one's a little mind-bending to me. I'm using an example of Azure API management. So we'll talk about that in the last module. There's some very cool things mm-hmm. that you can do with APIs in Azure. But this is a API that manages APIs. And that's why I wanted to show it as an example. So you've got to imagine if someone takes the time to write a set of RESTful endpoints that are designed to manipulate APIs, that they're going to be very structured in their approach and come up with something that makes sense. So if we look at the way that this is structured, and I've just pulled out a small piece, so we've got a collection of APIs, and this APIs 1 is really going to be a specific API that I have in my library, and then I can grab an operation off that, I can mm-hmm. set a policy for that. I have things like authorization server, certificates, products. I even have users, and I can map users to different types of APIs and do subscriptions. So here we've got a specific user. That's that user with the identifier of 1. And then there's a collection of their subscriptions. So these are the subscriptions they have access to.
Okay, perfect.
So those are two examples of very mature APIs and how they're structured.
And you're going to kind of keep digging into a couple of others later on. That,
yes.
If I remember right, you've got a little GitHub thing as well.
Exactly.
Okay, perfect.
That's a great API that we'll explore.
Excellent.
So the next thing I'd like to talk about is what you do once you get the resource. So we just talked about what is a resource, how do you access, and how do you design your resource. Well, then those resources are acted upon, and that's what verbs are about. It's basically how to plan the actions that are in your API. And so what I have is a list of common verbs. Now, there's many more verbs than this, but these are the ones that you're probably going to run into on a regular basis. And get is probably the easiest one to understand. That's just your simple read. And then this is where we had the little bit of mix-up is post and put. So the idea of...
I always get this backwards. Always.
Right. So the idea of post is that I'm posting something new into a collection. So usually the endpoint would be products, and then I have the information about a new product that I'm going to post. And then there's design questions behind the API, whether you return that product back with the ID populated, or if you just say, okay, I got the post, et cetera. So then the put is a replacement. So that's what I'm using for update, although there is also a concept called patch, a verb called patch that's designed to maybe modify just parts of an object. So maybe it can take a partial representation. And then, of course, we've got the favorite one everyone likes to use without any controls on it whatsoever is delete.
Yay.
Right? We'd love to clobber
easy.
Resources.
Yep.
Now, I said custom and proceed with caution. You can create custom verbs, but then you're stepping outside of this standard vocabulary we have to deal
right.
with.
Right. Yep.
Endpoints and services.
Yeah, it's sort of like if you create your own custom exception, which you can do, the problem with that whenever you're coding is, you know, the type of exception only makes a difference if you're expecting, if I know what's coming. So if you've created your own custom exception and you throw that, if I don't know about that in advance, in my exception handling, it's just going to wind up inside my generic exception handler, which really isn't going to help us. So you want to stay on the well-defined, on the well-paved path there. And then the exact same thing holds true when you're building up your own APIs and setting up which verbs you want. That, can you create a custom? Sure, but now you're going to be off that well-paved path. And as a result, people aren't going to be expecting that verb, and people are going to be a lot less likely to be able to use that. And it's yet again something else that we have to learn. So then we're sort of back to WCF and WSDL documents and trying to figure all of that out, which we don't want to do.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And that's, if you remember with the OData example, when I looked at the products, there was a link, and the relationship for that link was edit. It didn't say put, it didn't say post, it just said edit, because it's assuming that once I have that path to the resource, that I know what verbs I can use to operate on those. So what I'm going to do is, having talked about resources and verbs, is try to illustrate this through a practical example. And this is an example of an account transfer. So the concept here is that I have a collection of accounts, so I've already designed that into my API, that's this right here. Mm-hmm. And now I have the challenge that I want to take my account that probably has $6 in it, and I don't want to empty it out.
I know that bank account well, yep.
I don't want to empty it out, so I want to pull $5 from that account and put it into savings, so that when I do spend that last dollar, I know I've got some backup. Mm-hmm. How does that sound? So that's my second account.
I really wish you would stop looking at my checking.
So that's really the bottom line of what we've got, is how do I transfer $5 from account one to account two? So my first attempt when I go to design this API is, it's pretty simple. I've already got accounts defined, so why do anything different? What I can do is grab that account, subtract $5, and do a put. So I'm basically replacing accounts one that had $6 mm-hmm. with accounts one that has $1.
Okay.
Okay, and then I go and I grab my accounts two and I add $5 to it and I do a put on accounts two.
So you're really actually taking that account object, you're modifying the balance on that account object, and then putting it back into the server.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So that doesn't sound like that'd be a good thing.
That is not a good thing, and that's why I use that as the first example. So this is what it looks like, but the problem here is that we've got too much business knowledge, first off. So as a consumer, if I'm using this API, I've got to know exactly how to coordinate this transaction. That's one. But even scarier is, there's no controls. There's no transaction wrapped around it. It's really a one-time transfer.
Right. A lot of people have actually started asking about transactions and managing things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're going to talk specifically to that. But that is my biggest concern with this model, is that because I do it once here and once here, there's no guarantee that if something breaks down in the middle, that my accounts aren't out of sync. So we'll just go ahead and do a big X on this design. I actually put a couple X's, and we're going to try again. So what we'll do is we'll come...
I like the little X that you drew through there.
Exactly.
That's perfect. Ah!
So attempt number two, and I think this is a better approach, and you can see this illustrated here. So I've got accounts, and I'm in my specific account here, accounts one, and I'm going to create this concept of transfers underneath it. So basically, I create this transaction underneath the account. So what I'll do is I'll post, because I'm creating something new, into the transfers collection, and I'm going to give it the information that the amount is $5 and the target account is account two. And then I can come out and query this, right, with our navigation and look at that and say accounts one had a transfer one after I do the post.
So what you're doing is you're actually using now a transfer object, and then you're defining where you want to take the money from, how much money, and then where you want to send it to, so that everything is encapsulated now in that transfer object. So that way you're not downloading the two accounts, modifying those two accounts, and then sending them back up. Instead, you're saying, hey, this is what I want to do, and then letting the server figure out how to do that.
Exactly.
And kind of putting that logic where it should be, which is, again, back on the server.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's what we're doing there. There are still some challenges with this approach, however. And the challenges are number one, we're sort of assuming that accounts one owns the transaction.
Right.
And in some cases, that may be true, but really the transfer impacts both accounts. Mm-hmm. The owner is the bank that has the accounts, and the transfer impacts both accounts. So that's one issue I have with it. It's not as evident that accounts two, the second account, is impacted in this model. And navigation is a little quirky, because I have to go in through the first account to know that I impacted a second account. So I'm going to go ahead and scratch out this model. We'll just cross that out. And I'm going to go with a third attempt. Now, the idea behind this example is to really illustrate this idea that instead of remote procedure calls, we're dealing with resources and verbs on those resources. So what I'm going to suggest is that we have either a collection of transactions or more specifically in my diagram, I'm showing transfers. And if I have these collections here, transfers, transfers one, then what I can do is I can post an object that encapsulates the full transaction. It's got a source account, a target account, and the amount that's being transferred between the two. So now I can go through my transactions and I might have a source account collection and navigation and a target account collection and navigation. So I see exactly the two accounts that were affected by this. And I've gotten this back to the concept of a parent owning the full transaction.
Okay.
Now I do add this little guess what here, because is this way better than the last way? Well, it depends. There's really no right or perfect way.
Right. I would say of the three ways that you've shown, that's probably the best, because what I'm doing is I'm now just creating a brand new transaction object saying, hey, this is the source account, this is the target, this is the amount, and then I'm just tossing that one object up. That seems to be a little bit simpler than having to first navigate to the source and then saying, hey, this is what I want to do. Or that first example that you had where I'm actually going to pull down both of those account objects, modify them both, and then send them both up. So this seems to be the cleanest, and it also seems like, you know, it's just that one operation, and then that's it. And if something goes wrong, then the server can let me know that I had a problem there, be it authorization-wise, be it maybe, you know, I only had $4 left in my account as opposed to the $6 that I thought I had, you know, things like that.
Sure.
So, okay.
And this is really the crux of API design.
Yep.
Right? So you have to be intentional and think about how these resources are represented and think about them from the perspective of who initiates the transaction. And how much business logic are you really imposing upon the consumer of the API versus allowing your server to manage, because that's what you know. Your APIs are there because you know your business and you're allowing people to interact with that business that you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's the key behind that. So what I'd like to segue to in now is I'll call it a case study of an API, and we're going to dig a little bit deeper into what that API is, and that's the GitHub API, just to show this concept of resources and transactions in play. So I'm going to come back over to my Internet Explorer.
So, you know, while you're going into Internet Explorer, I'm going to just sort of tangent back real quick, because somebody asked sort of an interesting question about, hey, there's been a couple of questions. So one of them has been about domain-driven design and web API and kind of how to manage all of that. And then the other one is about that transfers object that you've created, and would that be a separate SQL table behind the scenes? And I'm going to kind of ball both of those up, because I think they both kind of asked the same question, just not directly, which is, hey, look, if you have a front end exposed out and you've got a transfer object, does that mean that it has to match your back end? And the answer to that question is no, that the back end object model that you're using can be different, that there's this sort of high-level concept known as model view, view model. And the basic goal there is, hey, look, I'm going to have my model, and that's going to be my back-end domain, and that's going to be the actual data that I'm going to wind up working with. But how that all of that works behind the scenes is not necessarily how somebody is going to work with it on the front end. And this transfer examples is a perfect example of that, because as we all know, a transfer at the end of the day is I'm going to deduct from one, and I'm going to put into another. So I'm going to have two account objects, and I'm going to modify both of those. But that's not what I want the client to do. I don't want the client doing that. We're going to do that on the back end. So I might be creating a view model, a model specifically for the client to use. They're going to send up that transfer object, and then I'm going to figure out behind the scenes what I want to do with that. Now, it very well might be that I'm going to take that transfer object, and I'm going to drop that straight into a database table for, say, logging purposes, for historical purposes. But that's not necessarily guaranteed that I might actually break that down into two separate transactions. That maybe what I do is I just load up behind the scenes the two accounts, I go ahead, I make those two little changes, and then I just log two separate entries inside my history that we deducted from this account and then we inserted into this account. So how all of that winds up working behind the scenes is really up to you. And again, that's sort of one of the great advantages here is that you can use Web API, you can create whatever object it is that you want up front, that's your facade, and use that to mask whatever it is that you're doing behind the scenes, which in turn means that if you want to change something behind the scenes, as long as you're not changing that front-facing API, as long as you're not changing that front-facing model, then the clients don't need to know about what it is that you've changed behind the scenes. And I think that sort of answers all of that.
It does. And the only thing that I'll really add to that is there's this tradition in design for software of data-driven design. So I'm going to create my database, and then I'm going to generate my code from my database. Mm-hmm. And we've got domain-driven design that says, let me create my domain.
Yep.
And then some people will take that and generate the database from the domain. I found in just my career specifically and my experience that it's really in the middle most times. In other words, I let the data architects do what the database does best, which is this relationship between data, and model that based on what we have to persist. But the coders, the people on the application side, they want something that's easy to maintain and use and understand. So let's model that after the domain, and then they'll meet in the middle, and there's incredible tools. I know MVA has courses on these like Entity Framework and the combination of Entity Framework and OData that allow that mapping to happen and kind of create that. But I would say, you know, when you're talking about domain-driven design and you have this concept of aggregate root, et cetera, it actually drives Web API design because you're looking at something very similar. You're, you've got collections and you're rooted where it's not as specific as, like you said, that transfer object might not be something in the database. I might coordinate that transaction through code and just impact what I need to persist, which is the account information. I might send that as an event into a queue, capture that event, then coordinate and store these. And so there's a lot of different ways to approach it. So the key is really to look at two sides of the equation. One side is how do I surface my API and make it easy to interact with and use and understand. The second side is then now on the business logic, what is my philosophy around how I manage those transactions and make them work?
Yep, absolutely. Perfect. And I, you know, if I could add one last little thing and then I think we can kind of move on that, that I think we've sort of really beaten this into the ground. but, you know, I just want to spin that into transactions in general that a lot of people have asked, you know, about persisting transactions and so forth. That one of the things to remember that I think unfortunately sometimes is lost with REST API is you still have to remember that you're making a web service call, that at the end of the day, this is still a type of web service. And whenever you're talking about web services, you want your calls to be chunky, not chatty. And I always used to say that when WCF first came out with WSDL, that it almost just made it too easy, that I could very easily just new up whatever that context object was going to wind up being, and then just make method call, method call, method call. And behind the scenes, it's just bouncing back and forth between the client and the server, which is not something that I really want. That I want to take all of that information, send it all up in one shot, and get one response back. And you want to still maintain that in your web API, your REST calls, that if I can give the client the ability to build an object, to put all of the information that needs to be in that needs to be sent up into that one object, they send all of that up to me. Now this makes life easier, that I don't have to worry about maintaining a transaction across multiple round trips, because I've got all the data. We also get better performance because we don't have those multiple round trips, that we've got all of the data. So if you can create that custom object, allow them to send everything up, then I just manage everything on the server side. So I just set up my transaction scope, or in the case of Entity Framework, that save changes is automatically transactional. So I just make the changes that I need to make, call save, and then assuming that there's been success, just send back that success message to the client, and away we go from there.
Sure.
So you know, again, kind of going back into that design, think about all of that. Think about that chunky, not chatty. Avoid those round trips, and it makes things like handling those types of transactions that much easier.
Right. And I love that chunky, not chatty, because the key is that you can create an object that just represents that transaction.
Yep.
It doesn't have to have all 500 fields that
exactly.
are in the database.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. So. Yep. Yeah, and you can create as many custom objects as you're going to need to maintain those different types of calls.
Exactly.
Yep.
So let's take a look at how GitHub actually approaches this.
Perfect.
Because I think it's a great example.
Yeah, so go look at what somebody else has built and then design based off of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're going to hit this top level. Now, I'm going to show you this. This is my first hit in Internet Explorer. So it does render the JSON, but we've got a little bit of a scroll. So because of that, I'm going to actually come over to the other browser. And pull this up. And so this is a little bit more well formatted. And there's ways to get around formatting, et cetera. But for this demo, we're going to dive in. So what I've done is I've hit an API endpoint that is the resource of me. So this is a little vain, but this is my resource. And what you can see, if we look at what's come back, we've got things like I've got a unique identifier, a login ID, and I've got this avatar URL, for example. So that's a resource that's returned from this service. So if I take this and just highlight this, and this is really only because I wanted to see me again, it pulls up my profile mug, right?
Just in case we forgot what you look like.
Just in case we forgot. But what you're going to see is we talked about Hate OAS and this idea that all I need is that top-level API and I've got everything I need. So what I've received back is not just my picture and information about me, but I can see pretty much anything that's possible for me to do with my GitHub repositories here. So I can find out what my followers are, who I'm following, et cetera. So I'm gonna come down here and we've got this repos URL. And so that's the list of repos that I have underneath my name. And by the way, let me do a little segue. You'll notice some of these have these squiggly braces. So this is a format for substitution of a resource.
Okay.
What it's basically saying is it's annotating that the top level URI is going to be Jeremy Lickness following, but then what I can do is optionally put a forward slash and put in the name of another user and navigate to that item.
Okay.
So it's just saying these are basically placeholders. It's not unsimilar to the way we define routes in mm-hmm. Web API, right? So that's actually a standard out there, and I can't remember the exact RFC number of that standard, but you can look up the standard for URI fragments and how to put those placeholders.
Yep.
So what we're going to do is take this repos URL, and I'm just going to grab that and bounce up here and navigate to that. And this is what I really love about the GitHub API, is it doesn't just give me the repos back. It knows that I'm exploring repos for a user, so it's going to bounce back the information about the owner to me.
So that way, if I was trying to build a GitHub client and I wanted to, you know, display their picture and do whatever, so that way, again, we could see what Jeremy looks like. you know, so if I want to do all of that, I've got all of that information in one shot that I don't have to go back to GitHub and say, all right, well, I also want the user. That if I want my default page that somebody lands on when they open up my app to be the list of repos and a little bit of information about that user, about that owner, which is something I would certainly want, I get that all in one shot that I don't have to make multiple calls for that.
Right. And,
okay.
and it really gets back to that concept of it being stateless.
Yeah.
I don't have to maintain state even on my client. It's given to me with each call, which
yep.
is pretty cool. So then we'll scroll down and we can see that there's a bunch of different repos in here. Mm-hmm. I've contributed to the AngularJS project, one of my claims to fame.
I know you'll be signing autographs later.
Yes, I
okay.
will.
Fantastic.
I know you've done some MVAs on that, so that's
yep.
exciting. But let me just come down and find an example one. So Angular Health App is a repo I have that's I basically built an app live at a presentation.
Okay.
So that's one of the repos I have. And if we look down here, we've got an HTML URL, which that will let us just navigate to the page you and I see when
okay.
we open it up in the web browser. We're no longer in the API if we go there. We've got a description URL, et cetera, et cetera. And what we've got also is I can see the commits that I've made, and I can see the contents. So I'm going to grab this contents URL. And notice this does have that little segment I talked about where there's a brace with the plus path. So that's how I navigate within contents. But I'm going to just go to this high level here, navigate to the contents. And then what we're going to get is an actual list of everything that's inside of that repo.
And links to all of that as well.
And links to all of that as well. You can see here I've got repo information, I've got this gitignore, SHA, et cetera. So I'm just gonna come into the README, and again, I can go straight to the HTML URL where someone can actually see it in their browser, or I can do these links to self, so this is through the API, et cetera. So let's just grab this API and see what this looks like. Paste this up here. And then that isolates that single resource. And then from there, I can go out, I can actually grab the blob from GitHub. I've got a Git endpoint, which interfaces with a Git client. I've got the type, I've got basically everything I need to know and see. And then of course, if I take this HTML URL.
And that will actually give you the
paste
the
markdown. That's gonna navigate me straight to the markdown page.
Awesome. Now, do me a favor, go back a couple of screens here. Go back one more, and that's a perfect example. So one thing that's really worth highlighting here is look at the amount of information that's been sent down. And, you know, if you're thinking about building a GitHub client, a lot of that information, and I would even actually argue a vast majority of that information is probably not something that you're going to display off. So I probably don't care about what the key token is. I probably don't care about the size. I probably really just want the URL, the title, and maybe that's about it. So that way I can just simply display that out. And I probably don't need the rest of that information. And so you might be thinking at that point, well, wait a minute. Why do I want to send down all of this extra information that the client isn't going to be using? I always like to simplify performance with web applications as two very basic steps. Avoid round trips and stay off the database. That round trips with HTTP are extremely expensive. That HTTP is just this big, fat, slow protocol. And the more calls that you wind up making on HTTP, the slower everything is gonna wind up being. So it's much better to send down too much information and avoid all of those round trips than it is to send down smaller little chunks of information and then ask the user to keep coming back for more data and more data and more data. And I would even go one step further, which is to say that if you take a look at JSON, if we bring the screen back up here real quick, if we take a look at JSON, you're going to notice that this is really distilled down to its bare basics, that it's just simply key value, key value, key value, that if we were to try to do this in XML, this would be huge in XML, because again, XML just brings a lot of bloat with it to the table. JSON is very light, and as a result, we can send down a lot more information using a lot less bandwidth using JSON than we can with XML. So to simplify all of that, sort of the moral of the story is don't be afraid to send down too much data, because in the long run, that's going to help avoid those round trips, which are actually going to wind up slowing down your application.
And that's a really great segue into the things that I wanted to call out from this.
Perfect. One, I love it when that comes together.
Is that you're sending the data down. But this has what I would say are the qualities of a really well-defined API.
Yep.
So not only does it provide you with all the data and give you the links to the different types of resources, so directly to the image, to the HTML, it also helps you navigate through the content. So you get this links collection that has self, Git, and HTML. So it's, excuse me, it's literally showing me the different actions that I can take with this.
Yep.
And I really didn't have to memorize this API to demo this.
No.
Right? I wasn't hunting around. As long as I hit that first one, I was able to find the different collections and drill down as deep as I needed to go.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let me pop out of there. So, going back to the comment you made about JSON and XML, part of that is content negotiation. And there are some times when maybe the client needs to work with XML for whatever reason. And you might have other formats as well to send. So all of this is part of content negotiation. And it's very important to understand this when you're designing your API, because it's how you generate different forms of data and how you comply with the standards around this. So the way that content negotiation works is it assumes that apps can consume content in different ways. And we all know XML used to be the most popular format. I remember in the 90s, if you built an application that was based on XML and XSLT, you were a wizard. Like, everything was XML driven.
I mentioned earlier that I was a trainer, and there was probably a good 3-year stretch between like 98 and about 2001, 2002, where like 90% of the classes that I was teaching was on XML. I mean, everything was all about XML. And
right.
Yeah,
it's now. Probably one of the more complicated languages that I learned was mm-hmm. XSLT. I was a wizard at XSLT,
yep.
and there's really just not much use for that anymore. But we did a lot for that. So now JSON's most popular, and that's for two reasons, really, because of the smaller, more compact data, and the fact that it's really easy to process through JavaScript, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of open source solutions. So a good service is going to support multiple content types. And a good client is going to know how to ask for the type that it expects or can work with the best. And out of the box, Web API does a really good job of handling that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to talk about that, and then we'll get into ways of offering custom content, et cetera. So for my content negotiation demo, I'm going to come into our basic design demos here. And I'm going to run this first so we can see what's going on. And I've popped up an Internet Explorer, and I've got it forbidden because I don't have any pages. I just have this API demo. And you can see I've got a bunch of JSON
yep.
that appeared.
All those key value pairs.
All those key value pairs. And I really just generated some random text, et cetera, for this. So what I'm going to do is pop over into my Postman tool. I'm going to reset to get things back to normal, just paste actually the request I just typed in. Let's go back here. So let me grab that path, paste that here.
There we go.
And issue a send. And again, it comes back as JSON.
Yep.
Now one of the
things. It's all pretty. See,
exactly.
It's on the pretty tab. See, it's pretty.
It's very pretty. And if we do the raw, it's sort of lumped together. If we
yep.
do the pretty, it's pretty. Now one of the things you'll notice by convention, JavaScript developers love to start variable names with lowercase.
Uh-huh.
And right now, these are coming back with uppercase. And we're going to talk about that in a minute because, again, there's all these switches and dials that we can use to change how we represent data. So,
yep.
so I'll come back to that. But all I'm going to do is come into my headers up here. So I've got headers. And I'm going to tell the server
yep.
that I accept data in a certain format. Now, I could say I accept JSON and send that, and I'm going to get the exact same thing back.
Nothing changed.
Because that's
yep.
what we saw. So now let me change that to, say, XML.
Okay. So now you're specifically telling the server I only accept XML.
That's right.
Okay.
So then I go ahead and send that, and now, lo and behold, we've got XML back.
Okay.
So that is an example of Web API playing fairly with content negotiation.
And if you take a look at that XML, you'll notice that that's a much bigger block of data there than the JSON was. The JSON very, you know, just key value.
Right.
And then that's much bigger. I mean, we could actually break that down and show you the different sizes and so forth. But I think you just look at that and you just immediately see, okay, yeah, there's a big difference there content size-wise between the XML and the JSON.
It's exactly correct, and it's more human readable, right? I mean, it's not just
yep.
more compact, it's just easier to read. So the other thing I'm going to do is make up my own. So I'm going to do application, and we'll call this the blah type. So let's request the blah type. You can see it came back in JSON. So there's actually a default that says, unless I want to really throw an exception, if I can't handle anything in the accept header, I'm just going to return a default. And you can also configure what the default is. Some people prefer XML to be the default. Some people prefer that JSON is the default.
Mm-hmm.
And JSON is the default by default, if you will.
Okay, the default.
The default.
Okay, and now we've sort of spun back around onto ourselves.
Right.
Yes. Yep.
Exactly. So having said that, I've jumped into these quite a bit, and I'll get back to that uppercase, lowercase thing in a second here. But I want to talk about tools for testing, because I've shown a couple
mm-hmm.
already. And what we want to do is we want to be able to test the API without having to rewrite the entire app. And we've done that type of development in the past, right? Where we've built the client and we've made the connections. And every time we make a change, we have to run it through the full app to see if it works. And we want to sort of short circuit that, right, as we're developing these APIs.
Yep.
So we've got several tools. And the first tool I'm going to talk about is built right into Visual Studio. Now, this isn't as much a tool for testing live the way you've seen me testing, but it is a tool for validating the way you've stood up your API and documenting your API. And that's called Web API 2.2 Help Page. Say that three times really fast. Web API 2.2 Help Page, right? I'm going to stop right there.
Okay.
But what this does is generates documentation.
Perfect.
And when we clicked on that Web API template back in Module 1, it automatically checked MVC for us.
Right.
And that's because it knew it was going to automatically install this Web API help package.
Oh, that's convenient.
Okay. So, okay. And this needs MVC because that's what's showing you the actual
And that help. Will actually give you the web page.
Exactly.
Okay. And actually, it's really cool that you mentioned this right now. I actually just answered a question in the chat window just a second ago, which is, you know, if I know REST, I'm still going to have to dig into what it is that particular server is doing. And the answer to that is yes, because REST does set standards. And that is a big part of being able to negotiate and work with the server. But the fact of the matter is that we still need to understand how to work with the data that's going to be coming back. So if I go into the Azure Management Services, that's going to be one type of data, and so I'm going to have to manipulate that one way. If I go into Twitter, that's going to be a different set of APIs. If I go into Health Graph from Runkeeper, that's going to be a different set of APIs. So I need to be able to figure out kind of how all of their data is structured, because after all, tweets versus run entries are going to be two very different types of objects, and how I'm going to work with each is going to be very different as well. So there's still knowledge that needs to be gained there, and that's where those help pages can come into play, so that way when you expose yours out, other people can then come along and figure out, oh, okay, this is what needs to be done here, rather than just digging into the JSON and trying to figure everything out that way.
Right, exactly. And
perfect.
And I'm going to jump into this project, and let me make sure I'm not still debugging here. We'll stop from debug. So in this content negotiation project, you can see I've got these areas and help page, et cetera. So it actually by default generates this under help, but I'm going to make a little change to show the way this works, and then we'll tweak that. So what you see is I have this method decorated with response type.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to comment that out for a second. I'm going to comment it out here. What is it not like?
You click on it. Click on the IHTP, and then just can. Yeah, you probably just. That's weird.
Yeah, that's very weird. Okay, well, I know what it is, so I'm just going to delete it, actually. We've got source control. We can revert. I think these are fake squigglies, if you ask me.
It might be a NuGet package that needs to be downloaded.
Let's see. Well, it runs. So let's do this. Let's navigate to help.
Okay. Just needed to be built.
All right, so this is a very boring page of documentation.
That is a very boring page, but it's documentation.
It is documentation.
Well, sort of. It then tells me no documentation
available. No documentation available. So what it's really saying is there is a Git API demo, but it can tell me a little bit about what comes back here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's giving me examples in JSON and in XML, so I can see that. But on some of these, if I go to like the specific ID, you'll notice the response formats. It's just telling me application JSON. It's not telling me what to expect, like IDs, et cetera.
Right.
Okay, so this is because in my code, I'm using this IHTTP action result. Now, I love IHTTP action result. It's the way I do all my web API, because what this does is it allows me to have sort of an open-ended result that I control completely.
So you can just send back whatever it is that you might want.
Exactly, and there's helpers that we're going to get into in future modules that cover this, but basically if it's not found, I can use the not found helper that's right here, so that gives the 404. If it's there, it's there. But you'll notice that the API
generation...
Exactly.
Okay
would be the 200. all the help documentation has to go off of is the signature of this method. It's not artificial intelligence that looks into my code and figures out, hey, if we go down this path, we're actually returning an item.
Okay.
So that's where this response type comes in. So if you'll see on this API, it was documented because I actually typed it as a demo item. Mm-hmm. So that demo item, it can read that from the signature, but down here it can't. So all I have to do is just say response type, and then I give it type of, and this is going to be a demo item, right?
Yep.
And then that is a clue to the API documentation that that is what we're going to receive. And let me just double check this. And we're getting squigglies again, but we're going to ignore them. We no longer trust the squigglies.
Don't trust the squigglies.
Don't trust the squigglies.
There is no spoon. There are no squigglies.
So I'm going to add that. And then delete doesn't need it because delete, actually it's deleted, so there's nothing to return. So let's spin that up again. Oh, this time we had build errors. And I'm missing a type of.
Yeah, and then you, of course, copied and pasted
the error throughout eternity. So we'll just take this and quickly do this. And okay, I think we should be good there.
Okay. It's always great. You make whenever you make a mistake, everybody in the chat window then immediately comes in. It's like pair programming to the end.
I love that. Yeah. That's one thing between being on a webinar versus in person.
Yeah.
Is I love the helpers in the audience when you're live coding that said, wait, you didn't do this.
Yes.
And you're always just testing them, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, that's all we were doing. You meant to do it that way.
Mistakes.
Yeah, we're just making
sure everyone's awake.
But yeah.
But we've got that. So now I go into help with audience participation. I come into this get demo ID, and now we can see it understands the structure of what's supposed to come back because I gave it that tip. So that response type, contrary to popular belief, does not, and I'm not sure it's a popular belief, but I thought this when I saw it, it doesn't dictate the actual response type. It's just a clue for the documentation to understand how to document that API. Mm-hmm. But now we've got full documentation. If we used our comments, which we should always comment code where it makes sense, those comments would come out and appear on this documentation as well. So it's a pretty powerful set of tools.
Nice. I like it. Okay.
So that is the Web API 2.2 help page. And if you don't have it already in your project, you drop into NuGet. I'm going to show you that in Visual Studio. You come into your tools. You go to your NuGet package manager, and you go into the console, and then you'll just type in your console. Let me zoom in a little bit over here. So you can see down here, I've got this console down here. And you just type install hyphen package, and then there's a really long name that we have on the slide deck. Right? So it's microsoft.asp.net.webapi.helppage, and that will add it to your application.
Perfect.
Okay? So I already showed you Postman. Postman is an extension to Chrome, and that is what I'll be using a lot of here just because it's a very simple in the browser interface, so it's easy for me to show things that are happening. There's another great tool that's completely free called Fiddler. And Fiddler is a little bit more than just a REST testing tool. Fiddler is actually a way of diagnosing websites in general because it filters web packets. So what I can do is pop up my, I almost did not Fiddler, so there we go, Fiddler. So I've popped it up, so if I come back into my Chrome and I do a request here, what'll happen is over in Fiddler, we can see the request. That request came in here, and then over on the right-hand window, we can actually see what the headers looked like. For that request, mm-hmm. we can go in and see what the result was. So if it's JSON, if it's XML, it's not going to parse because it came back in JSON. And then I can actually compose and test from here as well. So I'm going to right-click and do replay or reissue from Composer.
Right.
So I'm going to click on that. So that takes a snapshot of the request and then gives me this ability to edit it. So you can see here, accept application blah. So what I'm going to do is change that to application XML because remember it was returning JSON. So we just make that change and I come over here and click execute. And then we see the request popped up here. If I double click on it, now I'm by default in my XML tab
okay.
over here. And so what it did is it issued it with the accept XML header. And now I've got a nice way, if I go to my, I think there's a text view, I can see that XML, which if you can read that, my hat off.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, you know, difference between Postman versus Fiddler. And I think you just, you did a perfect demo there. That the great part about Fiddler is that it does give you that ability to really get very low level. And if you want to see every last little header, if you want to manipulate every last little part of your request, you can do that. But with Postman, it just sort of takes a lot of that for granted. And it gives you the ability to modify and tweak kind of the big things that you're typically wanting to modify, and then takes care of the rest for you.
So I think the rest. It does take care of the rest
for you. That pun was not intended.
So really, I look at Fiddler as a sort of a troubleshooter for the web in general.
Yep.
So anything you can do over HTTP or HTTPS. And then Postman is very targeted towards specifically RESTful APIs.
Yep.
So I already demoed the testing tools, got ahead of myself, was so excited.
I do that all the time. Yeah, I get to that demo slide, and just next slide. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And so the last thing I wanted to cover, and this segues into the question we had at the beginning, is what is so good about REST? And so we're going to look at consuming REST with jQuery, because I think JSON is such a good thing. And so consuming a RESTful API with jQuery is very straightforward, and there's a lot of other tools and frameworks. I picked jQuery because it's the most used framework out there. And we've got this AJAX that handles verbs, put, post, get, URLs with resources, data, data types, etc. And the fact that the data is coming back in JSON makes it really easy for us to turn it into a JavaScript object. So let us take a look at consuming that. So I'm going to come back into my content negotiation. Let's stop this. And I'm going to take this HTML, set it as my start page.
And that's just straight HTML. There's nothing fancy. You're not doing MVC or anything.
I'm going to open it up actually in a second. I want to show what it does first, and then we'll reverse engineer the code.
Okay.
So what it did is it just got my list of items from the server using the same API we've been talking about. Now, I can click on one of these, and it tells me it's ready to edit the item. So let's change this to 99999. We can click Update, and now you see down here it changed to 99999.
Okay. And that's all doing, there's no full-page post back there. That's all just JavaScript making the HTTP web request calls.
Right. And actually, I'm going to show you one more thing here in a second. Let's take this and delete it. Are you sure you wish to delete it? No, don't delete it. Okay, yes, we will delete it. Okay, and so it deleted that item. So we did a few things here.
And now, it's now missing from the list.
I happen to be running Fiddler
in the background.
So what I can see is the initial request to get the list. And let's just zoom in here. So that's that initial request. I can see this request to get a specific item. So the resource was the identifier of that item. And then we got that specific item back. And then I can see that we did a put to replace it. That's where we updated it with that 99999. And I can also see we should have a delete. Yes, so this header is delete. And that's where we deleted the resource. And what we got back was really just this 200. Okay, it's deleted. Everything's good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I tried to reissue that same request, so let's do replay reissue from composer and execute that, you can see it gave me a 404 not found. So that is, again, my API is playing well. And instead of just throwing a random error, I said the resource that you asked me to delete is not there. Sorry, can't help you. But at least you know why I can't help you.
Yep.
And that takes us to the end of this module.
Okay, perfect. Well, then in that case, what do we say we take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll kind of keep digging in and taking a look at how to expand our web API from there. So we'll see you guys in 10 minutes.
All right. See you in 10.